Hello, listeners, and welcome to the Poetry Salon Cast. I am Tricia Faye Hefner.
And I'm Douglas Manuel.
On each episode, we interview one of our favorite poets to ask about their latest book.
What was difficult and what was easy about writing it.
And my favorite question, what do they do with a rough draft that wants to play rough?
If you want to hear more about the writers we interview and work with them in person, you can attend a live reading and workshop with them at the Poetry Salon.
Find out more and register for great workshops and events with us and our favorite poets at www.thepoetrysalon.com.
Now, without further ado, welcome to this week's episode of the Poetry Salon Cast.
Edward, are you ready?
Yep.
All right, take it away.
In the cemetery, a tombstone, a sorrowful gray, there lies a poet, his only visitors, pigeons, the occasional writer with a pad and pencil, conjuring inspiration from the grave, a child, the birthday flowers and tears of remembrance, the friend, reads new poems from an anthology of odes to rust, carved granite slowly becoming a memory. But did the poet not write about this, the grave, death, obscurities? The undertaker listens, walks with a slow wither. That's what feeding grackles will do to a pensive man, lost in his slow walk, like a stray bullet. Mounds of marble, teeth of the city, sinking into the gums of the earth, cavities of silence. The narrow lips of father, the knuckles of abuelita, the debt suit of abuelo, the four winds of pandemia. In the cemetery, curtains drawn down, every day is a celebration of life. Time passes, nothing changes. Music comes in the form of footsteps and moans. Flowers are pushed up for the living. Flowers are pushed up for our grief. Cry howl. 1. In your morning fog, yawning at daybreak, I feel your suck and moan in letters. Steal me an avocado from the grocery store, or ask father, he gives them away for free. Cry when she cries, cry. Howl as you die, howl. Cry for my city running on warning, and low wattage on low wages and melting asphalt. Howl in your pastel, queer dreams and flip-flops from the top of the stairs and heroin-blasted toes. Cry, howl on Juneteenth for the real beat lyrics of Amiri, Kaufman, and Leroy. Cry, howl the disappearance of privilege and the ugly squads, the sinking of ships carrying conservative literature printed in China for the hypocrisy. Cry when she cries, cry. Howl as you die, howl. Cry, howl for Lawrence and Jim Morrison and Robert and Bob and Roque and Francisco. For the new strain, for the math in pandemia. To our dead, for you we cry. For you we howl. For you we drink. For you we eat. For you we kill. For you we harvest. For you we work. For you we develop. Howl, here come the UFOs, here come the blamed, here come the white teeth. Nothing has changed. The avocado seed sprouts a root. Howl, like the quarantine dogs, the shuffling winds from the east, like the wailing orchestra of orphans, like a city underwater, moonless. Cry for the absence of music, for the spilt milk, for the herniated disc along the border, for its water. Cry when she cries, cry. Howl for the ghetto girls, for the bass in your face, for January 6th pardons, for strange fruit, for boycotted fruit, for books. Howl as you die, howl. To the new administration, pick a nation. Bitcoin buys me pupusas, but don't come here, we'll send your ass back. Put the beast on reverse, coffins on high demand, pipelines shut down, sacred land spared for now. crying to the river, howl between the mountains' cleavage, into the dead eyes of lonely streets, howl, cry on the perfect canvas of oil paint, take the spirit of the steed, shoot your bullets up to the clouds, morph them into straight stretched veins. 2. Ain't no big thing, nationwide shortage of chicken wings, someone is crying into the phone of gluttony. 3. Cry for the smell of age, howl and blot out my rebellion. 4. My skin tags play a game of hide and seek when I sleep, my nose bleeds when I get horny and fussy. I drip poets into the drain of murals, into the drain of obscurity. 5. Cry, howl, I still love the way your voice spreads like cream, when the hummingbird sucks on spoiled nectar, and how the earth is crashing down into a merlot hue, while Whitey sits on the moon, and I don't know why we mistook our tears for water. Howl as we climb the tree that thrives on loneliness, cry when we get to the top and find a rope. 6. Cry when you don't make it, howl where all the dead lie, make a revolution with fire and blood, especially if the dead are children.
Oh, wow. What a perfect way to begin. You are listening to the voice of Edward. I'm going to screw it up again. Say it again, Edward.
Vidaurre.
Vidaurre. Okay.
There you go.
Edward is an award-winning poet. He is the 2018 to 2019 City of McAllen, Texas Poet Laureate, 2022 inductee into the Texas Institute of Letters, publisher and editor-in-chief of Flower Song Press and its sister imprint, Juventud Press. Vidaurre resides in McAllen, Texas with his wife and daughter. Edward, that is just really a perfect way to begin. I got chills hearing you read the last lines of Cry, Howl, especially if the dead are children. I just want to say, as Doug did at the beginning, just our hearts go out to you and everyone who's in Texas and really all over America right now who's dealing with this most recent terrible tragedy.
Thank you so much. It's incredible how poetry stays relevant. This was a poem that was written before, of course, Uvalde, and after, of course, Sandy Hook and all the other places where children have been murdered in schools. You know, we also have the children that are losing their lives crossing the border here from Mexico to Texas, or Mexico through the United States, kids from Central America, South America, and other parts of the world. But it also speaks to children just in general. It could be a kid here in school. It could be a kid looking for a better life. And so, yeah, I forgot that that's what the last stanza included. But as I was reading the poem, I was kind of looking into the next few lines, and I was like, oh, this poem.
Oftentimes when I was reading this text, Edward, I felt as though that you were a poet of witness, but also a poet of resistance. And I think this poem strikes that balance and like shows how your work walks that tightrope. So could you talk about how those two impulses kind of inform your work, witnessing for so many people and so many bodies? There's so many elegies in this piece, so much recuperation for people who are usually avoided. But then also there's so many allusions to the Black Arts Movement and so many revolutionary movements, even from the Chicano movement here in the States and everywhere, really. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that, my dear friend.
I think if I'm going to consider myself a poet of resistance and activism, then I need to tackle everything that my world speaks of. We're still having people being sprung up on trees and hung. It's not just back in the day. For me to ignore that, for me to ignore that it's happening to other people of color, it'll be ignorant and it'll be disservice to what I'm trying to do, because I'm waving that flag of activism. I'm waving that flag of Black Lives Matter. I'm waving the flag of keep kids off cages. I can't stay quiet about children dying in schools. I mean, I edited a piece with a friend of mine. We edited a collection in memoriam for the kids who died in Sandy Hook. Like I said, my daughter was the age of those kids at that time. And now I see it, and it's like it's starting all over again. So it's, yeah, poetry of witness and responsibility. That's been, I guess, my calling, you know. I do write poems about my cat, and I do write poems about, you know, nature. But what's really taking over my life is a growing child, mental illness in the community, schools, you know. And I'm not one to just sit and watch the news all day, but I do pay attention to what's being said. I no longer act to breaking news updates because it's just something to grab your attention and make you freak out. And I noticed that when the past president was here, I was on always anxious, always wanting to pick a fight with social media. It was not very good for my health. And so I started to just, okay, well, breaking news, FBI storms the offices of Rudy Giuliani. And I remember when they said that, and I was with my daughter, and I told her, now let's ignore that and let's come back to it in a week and see what happened to that storming of the offices of Rudy Giuliani. And nothing ever happened. So anytime there's breaking news, somebody said this, and like I said, bread and circuses.
That answers a question that I've had, and I'm sure so many of us have been dealing with lately, is like, how do you balance paying attention to what's going on in the world with maintaining your own sanity and being able to focus on your family and not getting so caught up in this drama?
Right now, they're making it into a circus. They're making it into entertainment television, you know. And I started noticing things like this when 911 happened, when I just said, why do they keep looping over and over a plane crashing into a building? Because people want to see tragedy. The same was happening with Uvalde. They kept showing the same cops running towards a car and parents running. And I was like, they're showing the same bit over and over. And it's because there's action in it. There's color, there's yelling, and people want to know what happened, what's going on. As long as the tragedy's not happening to them, they want that entertainment. They're feeding what people want. And we can't always blame them. It's what we want. And unfortunately, it'll take a country, it'll take more than just a few poets responding, but it'll take parents in the household making those tough decision. We're not going to watch this. We're not going to buy this. We're not going to listen to this. That's where we're at.
I think that's wonderful. And also, I mean, you're absolutely right. I even know for myself, I've got the news on loop all the time, and I know what it is too. It's the same reason I drink cup after cup after cup of coffee. I just want the stimulus. How old are your, is it more than one child, or do you just have the one daughter?
I have one daughter, and she just turned 15.
A full-fledged human being now. And how does she react to you curtailing some of the news?
Well, you know, she listens. I know that she doesn't give me much feedback because she's learning, so she pays attention. And I just tell her, pay attention, don't react. Don't act on something that's just being fed to you. She's going through a different kind of upbringing than I did. I grew up in Los Angeles. I grew up in the projects, and I saw a lot of death. She's seen things happening or potential things that can happen to her that I thought coming over here to live would take her away from that. But it's as if death just follows people. She's at her age, she's had some trials and adjustments to a new life. It's like when there's an earthquake, all of a sudden life just seems different. It changes. your routine is not your routine anymore. And so she lost a cousin early this year, and then she lost a boyfriend from school recently to accidental overdose. I don't remember being 15 and having to have my heart broken that way. It didn't come until later, you know, when I was losing friends because of drugs and crime and stuff like that. But I think it's different when you're very innocent and you're not involved in things and you die. Like the children, yeah. they were doing nothing. They received their awards and they were happy for a summer upcoming. It's different when you die that way than if you're running in gangs and you're out there being a menace to society. People need to realize that when you die and you're involved in those things, yeah, they mourn you for about a week, but that's it. It's ugly to say, but you kind of had it coming to you. You were looking for it. And that's something that we need to tell our children too. It's like they say in Spanish, el que anda entre la miel, algo se le pega. If you're amongst the honey, something's going to stick. What do you want to stick? Who do you want to be around? Who are the people that you want around you? And who do you want your influencers to be or your role models? Is it the gang member who's dealing drugs? Or is it the mentor, the school teacher that's doing their best at a minimum rate of pay, but they're living to inspire?
Doug, do you have something you wanted to jump in there?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, hearing you talk about the kind of daily malaise and the routine of seeing the images on repeat again and again and how that exhausts us and make us so tired. And then I think about like your text, and I think about the way repetition works within your work, the way you use anaphora, the way you have so many callback lines and through lines, especially when we're thinking about a long poem like Cry Howl. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the role that anaphora and epistrophe play in your work and how you bring that kind of musicality. Because yes, these are songs of resistance. Yes, these are songs of witness. And so, yeah, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about repetition and how that helps you organize the text at large and individually within poems.
Yeah, I just started doing that recently with my work. And it's just, I feel like doing that just kind of refreshes the next part that I'm going to go into. Okay, I've said my piece with this. Now I'm going to shock you with something new or inspire you with something new or just, you know, freshen it up. It makes me also, when I'm writing it, think of a new way to create. I don't know. It's kind of weird. You know, that's a good question. I noticed that it's a renewal every time after I repeat something like Cry Howl or Cry When She Cries Cry. It's just kind of like a reset.
No, I really love this idea of it being renewal, of repetition has renewal. You know, Stein always talked about that every piece of repetition, every utterance is always different each time, even though you're saying the same thing. So, you know, I really like the kind of insistence the repetition makes and the kind of obsessions that it shows. But really where you got me, though, is that idea of renewal, that like it's different every time we come back. That's really powerful.
Well, it's like staring at a river. I don't know if you've ever been a child and you go to like a riverbank and it seems like you're looking at the water go over the same rocks over and over again. But if you keep watching, you'll notice that maybe it'll move the rock. It's got a different flow. And then you start to wonder, what's going on up ahead? What's going on up on top that's making it go faster? Or what slowed it down? It's the branches in the river of my poems that either make it stop or go a little faster.
That's lovely. You know, as you're talking about this and using that as a metaphor, you know, I want to say reading your book, it's so apparent that you have real attention to detail. Just really closely observing what you see, the imagery in front of you. And I felt like there were so many places in this book where I was really caught off guard by the surprise of the language. Can you talk a little bit about how you make that happen? How do you generate a poem? Is there a particular way that you get into the writing of a poem?
Usually it starts with a line, or I get inspired by reading, let's say, poetry by someone who's not really much of an activist. And this is what I always tell novice writers, especially where they want to create this body of work that's amazing. And I tell them, you know, every poet has an epic line in them. It doesn't have to be a book, but it can be a few epic lines that someone else will read and say, wow, that just inspired me to write, or it conjured up a memory. And it could be something as simple as saying the word lullaby, or just bringing something up. When I feel like I have a pause in my writing, you know, I hate to call it writer's block because I just don't think there's such a thing. I think it's just your heart and mind taking a break and re-energizing before their next creative explosion. But it's not a block. It's just you having to rest. It's just you having to maybe read a little bit. I don't write every day because there's days where I just feel like it's more important to read than write at the moment. I'll go through these moments where I'll write 3-4 poems, one after the other, and they don't connect with each other, the poems. But sometimes something in the poem from the one I wrote before, again, conjures up an inspiration or a line for the next one.
I love that idea that every poet has a couple great lines in them. I mean, that kind of makes it much more doable. Like, can I get a few lines down that are good lines as opposed to, you know, can I write an epic poem? I'm wondering who you're reading, or who were you reading when you were writing Cry Howl that helped inspire you?
Well, I wasn't reading Ginsberg. You know, Howl is in there, but I have read Ginsberg. Honestly, I was reading Miguel Hernandez. I was reading some of my older books that I've written that I just don't go back to. And just kind of to find myself again, or just to see what it is that I was doing. Not so that I won't do it again, but just to see how my voice has changed or grown. But I was reading Miguel Hernandez, and I was reading Wanda Coleman. I was reading Naomi Shihab Nye. But then I read a lot too, you know, I read a lot of other stuff. During Black History Month, I was going back to the books that got me into literature. I barely graduated high school, and I would take the bus to school, and I would notice everyone was reading something, and I was the only one just sitting there on an hour and a half, you know, ride to work, and just watching my life pass. What I was looking outside the window, just watching the city pass me by, and I was like, I need a look at something else. I need to read. And so I remember a high school teacher gave me Man-Child in the Promised Land. And that book was, it was just so amazing to me. And it opened up a world of literature because I didn't know that people of my color wrote books. I didn't see it. So I ate up Black history. I ate up Black literature. I read Richard Wright and Claude Brown and, I mean, whatever I could. I could relate to it because it talked about a struggle. I was living in the projects, and I saw the drugs and the crime and the police abuse and stuff. I always go back to those poets of witness to help me because they've led me all this way. So I like to revisit them, kind of like a thank you. I read a lot of, you know, I'm a publisher, so I'm reading a lot of manuscripts. Not forgetting those that came before us, but also not ignoring those that are doing the work today.
We'll get back to that interview in a moment. If you enjoy this podcast and want to learn more about us, log on to thepoetrysalon.com.
Most writers need a community around them to sustain their motivation and excitement for writing. The mission of the Poetry Salon is to provide inspiration, education, and support for poets everywhere at a price that is affordable.
Together, we are building a thriving community through online classes, e-courses, and readings, so you have the tools to live the life of a growing, prolific, accountable writer.
You also get opportunities to share your work and receive supportive feedback. Then turn your finished pieces into journal submissions, building an audience for your writing.
Again, visit thepoetrysalon.com to find out more and register today.
I'm really curious. First of all, did you go to high school in Los Angeles?
In my senior year, my mother sent me off to Oxnard, California, to live with an uncle because they shot up the flat where we lived. And my mom says, I'm not gonna die or let you die. So I'm gonna ship you off with your uncle. And my uncle was pretty tough, you know? And so I lived a year with him and went to high school and finished it there because he was there making sure that I got the job done.
Oh my gosh, Edward, that's such a story. I mean, the reason I bring that up, I'm so surprised, even at this day and age, that there are kids not knowing the breadth of literature out there. There's this great interview with Lucille Clifton and Sonia Sanchez. And Sonia Sanchez, I think she would have graduated college like in the 50s. I mean, it was a while back. And she talks about not knowing that there were African Americans writing. And she goes to some library or bookstore and someone tells her, like, here's like a special bookstore of all African American writers. And she's like, well, that's got to be a really small bookstore. She didn't even know. And then she talks about being enraged at how she didn't even know and no one told her. And I'm just still surprised because maybe I'm very, very lucky. I went to school in California and I remember some of the first books that I was reading in junior high, at least, were definitely broadening my horizons. I've always lived in a world where people of every color write books. That's never been a surprise for me, you know? So I'm just really shocked to find out that hasn't been the case for everyone.
Right, right. The books that I remember teachers giving us were Of Mice and Men, To Kill a Mockingbird, and a lot of Shakespeare. And that's where my rebellion and my rejection of Shakespeare in high school was probably the best thing I ever did for my own future learning, because I told her I didn't want to hear anything that was about Shakespeare. I go, nobody in my hood talks like that guy. Nobody that I know that's an adult talks like that guy. Why do we need to learn about this guy? And she's the one who told me, just keep your mouth shut. Let the class pay attention because they want to, but I've got something for you. And she's the one who introduced me to Man-Child in the Promised Land. And I thought, why aren't we learning? Why aren't we being taught this? And I understand now the appreciation for art, the appreciation for Shakespearean literature. It was at the root of that, but help me understand why, instead of just telling me to listen and read, you know. I'm sure a lot of people came out of that inspired by Shakespeare, and that's fine. But again, not every child learns the same way. Maybe at the time, Shakespeare was difficult for me. I wasn't learning through that. And so I think more of an explanation of why we chose to tackle Shakespeare would have been helpful. But then again, introduce me to people that look like me. Introduce me to those that are writing lives of what maybe my grandmother went through. Because we go through life and we don't know our grandparents and we don't know them, and there's nothing out there telling us about them either. So now we're trying to recreate our ancestry through literature and just stories being told down by our elders. And we're losing them little by little. We're losing a lot of the good storytellers in our families.
Yeah, no, it's really cool hearing you talk about your own personal canon and who have been the people you return to talk to and to inform your work. And I see that so much in this whole text, so many allusions. I mean, from Gil Scott-Heron to, that moment of when you have that little shout out to Whitey on the Moon. So I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about intertextuality and allusions. You know, allusions, I always tell students, work has a cool shortcut and
create a moment of communion with the reader, because you guys both know this little pop culture reference, or you guys both know this reference from another poem. So could you talk about how you use allusion and intertextuality to make meaning in your poems?
Well, I use it more to do just that, to have people or the reader think, what does that mean? Where do you get it from? Because, you know, I'll listen to some West Coast hip hop and I'm thinking no one else but the people in LA will understand Crenshaw Boulevard and all of these streets. But there, you know, I'm like, there needs to be a hip hop masterclass to teach people what the references are and that it's not just words being thrown out. Yeah, you know, Whitey on the Moon, and people nowadays hear it more because of the billionaires in space, right? It's so beautiful because a lot of the new generation will come and find out who Gil Scott-Heron is. And then when they find out about him, they're going to find out about others in his circle and what was being said. For me, it's more of a teaching tool in a very subliminal way, I think. I was the one who always loved to read the little things. I would open up the jackets to the tape and find out where that beat came from. That's how I was introduced to Parliament, and that's how I was introduced to Chaka Khan, and that's how I was introduced to, you know, Miles Davis and the jazz. And then from there, wow, it's a whole new world. I just hope that people that are writing nowadays do research on things like that. These are things you can't be taught in school. You learn as you go. I do it because I don't want to be lazy. I don't want to be a lazy writer. I want to be someone that does put in a little seed there for someone to water and let it sprout into their mind and find out that there's a large world out there of information. Is you can't get enough of it. So that's why I think I write that way. Also because I just like doing what hip hop did to me. Make me do research, make me think. Because it wasn't just drugs and shootings, and it was a lot more. These writers that I think about and you think about, and like, they memorized their writings. That's something I don't do. That's something that I'm not that type of a poet where I can memorize a poem from start to finish, because I feel that what I write is very important and I don't want to read it in a way where I'm going to mess up halfway through and people will just remember that part. So I want them to remember the body as a whole.
Yeah, I have to break in here to tell you how much I loved the poem Return to Love LA because of all of those specific references that, having lived in LA for 10 years, like, I understood those references. And all three of us here have lived in LA. Doug is still in LA. I don't know how off-putting that might be for someone who isn't an LA artist, but I'm also thinking about, oh, what's his face, you know, who wrote the song I Love LA, and he's all like, Century Boulevard, we love it.
Yeah, yeah.
Santa Monica Boulevard, we love it, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Clearly people who haven't lived in LA still know that song and love that song.
You go to the game and you'll hear it there. California always comes back to me in poems. I just finished a poem that I titled California Dreamin'. It never leaves me, even though I'm in Texas. Because, yeah, I think about it. I have family there. It's been a part of me. And I still have lived in California longer than I lived in Texas. But growing up somewhere is totally different from growing old somewhere. Being a kid somewhere where you learn everything, your first heartbreak, your first tragedies. A lot of your firsts are different from a lot of your lasts.
I think that's really well put. So let's talk a little bit about the struggle of writing poetry. When you come to difficulties in your writing, what are some of the things you do?
I try to do a lot of rereading of my work. I just want to make sure that, again, I don't sound the same. And sometimes it does afford for you to have to sound the same, because it's kind of like the DNA of my work, where this is the type of poet he is, and this is what he does. But I also like to change it up to where I surprise those that have read my work and for them to think, wow, that's totally different. But when I do have a struggle with writing, like I will read, I'll listen to music. I have 5 dogs. I love to go to the backyard and watch them run around. Just look for something that's going to replenish that struggle, whatever it is. If it's something that I'm going through mentally, just go to the things that bring me peace. It's rare that I take naps, but when I do, I never regret it, and I should take more of those. I guess growing up and just feeling like life was short, growing up in the projects, I still have that anxiety of life that you need to do a lot of work. But now it's not just doing a lot of work, but doing quality things in life so that I leave a legacy for my daughter and I leave something that will maybe inspire a generation of little brown boys, you know, little brown girls to say, hey, you know, he did it. I can do it too.
You definitely do feel like a poet of place. Do you think that moving to Texas changed your poetry, changed your approach? I'm very interested in how where we are informs who we are. And so I was just wondering if you could just talk about place in general and how it informs it. Like, are you still like, you know, West Coast, you still throwing it up? Or now, you know, you're like, don't mess with Texas. Like, which one dominates the imagination?
The one that dominates the imagination is still Los Angeles. I'm still West Coast, but I have a special relationship with Texas in a way where I'm more of the anti-politics of Texas. So I feel like I wasn't a poet until I came to Texas. I was maybe becoming one, but life was so fast and crazy. I was always working that I never really knew that I could tap into that part of that world. And so when I came to Texas, it was a little slower. And now I'm catching up to that California poet through my writings. But Texas is still there getting the mean mug from me because it's not being respectful to life. It's putting a lot of barriers on women. And so I've come here, I feel like, for a purpose. You know, I feel like a greater being or something in the universe said you need to be in the borderland of Texas. And I don't want to sound full of myself, but it's not just me trying to do work, also as a publisher, making sure that those voices are heard. And so California love, I'm still not crazy about what Texas does, not even to its artists. Our own Texas poet laureate at the time, he's a big activist and fighting the good fight. It's important to not be so proud of something that you shouldn't be proud of, even if it's even family. If you know of a family member that's very just like a bad person, then you separate yourself from toxicity. And Texas is that toxic family member.
Yeah, well, I think there's definitely a divide in this country in a lot of places between the artists of a place and the politicians of a place. And on the note of artists in Texas and artists, I notice one of the first endorsements for your book comes from Naomi Shihab Nye, who has been in Texas since she was 14 years old. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you have been able to study with her or connect with her at all. She's another great Texas artist that really holds space and upholds places for diverse voices.
Right. When it comes to academia, again, I barely graduated high school. Naomi was here several years back for the Texas Institute of Letters. She was being given the Lifetime Achievement Award, if I'm not mistaken. And I was the poet laureate at the time of the city. And so I was invited to come to the banquets and stuff. And I was lucky to have sat at the table with her. And I was also lucky to meet her and her mother. We became friends, instant friends. I don't know much of how she teaches, but I know how much she is an inspiration. And just listening to her and reading her work, and she's an activist too, you know.
Yes.
She writes some very, very strong words out there for, and people listen, and that's beautiful.
That makes perfect sense. I think I've been reading Naomi Shihab Nye since year one of wanting to be a poet. And I can see your crossover, obviously having some of the same interests and activism. And at the same time, the art is very, it still makes very strong art. There's such beauty in the writing. I also want to talk a little bit about Flower Song Press. Douglas and I got to interview one of your writers, Kai Coggin, who recently had a book out with Flower Song Press. And I think that's part of how I got to know you and your press. Can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to found that press and, you know, and how's it going so far?
Well, I was a poet published through the press when it was Flower Song Books. And the publisher and founder of Flower Song Books is David Bowles. And so it was a conversation we had, and I said, hey, who are you going to publish after me? And he was so busy, you know, children's books, and he was winning awards, and he just didn't have time for it. And he told him, there's no way. I was like, I don't want to be part of a press that's going to fold. He told me, well, why don't you take it over? And I didn't know what the hell I was getting into. But I knew that if I did, I was going to make it something that was going to be for everybody, that was going to get the voices of those that were not being heard. And I didn't know how I was going to do it financially, but, you know, I was lucky, and I am lucky. I've got some really good friends that are very skilled, and we've been able to put out a lot of books, and we're averaging about 25 books minimum a year. And we're on our fourth year. I think we started with 7 and then a few more than that the following year. And then we jumped over 20 and then now we're doing 25. And I think that's a good number.
That's incredible. First of all, I have to say, I love this story. I have heard so many folks talk about having a book published and then the press folds. And at the same time, I know so many other people who are starting their own presses. And I keep thinking, like, why would you let a press fold? Why wouldn't you just find someone else and turn it over to them? There's no reason that, you know, I just think poets are bad marketers, and they need to learn how to market and communicate and get it together with each other a little more.
Well, you know, something that's been really good in the West Coast is that the Flower Song authors there have created their own community of traveling poets from the press. So they're Flower Song poets that are trying to do readings together at different venues. I mean, they even travel to New York and all over California. And so that's something that very rare when it comes to artists working together, because there's a lot of ego, there's a lot of things that go with being an artist sometimes, that it's kind of, you know, well, I want to be the one that shines when I do a reading. I don't want to be in a group. But the community that they're constructing is helping all of them. And of course, you're still the individual poet where your work is going to be read and it's not going to be compared because you're not writing the same thing. So it's just being able to embrace community. And then you can still branch out of that. It's like you're in a band and then you want to put out a solo hit, or someone wants to interview just you. You do that. But you have to do it for yourself. You have to look for it. I tell them, look for people that are doing podcasts. Ask them. You know, look for people that are writing reviews. And I tell them, it doesn't cost much to give someone a free book if they're going to do something with it, as opposed to giving a bunch of free books to cousins and brothers and sisters and uncles and grandma and grandpa who won't even give you feedback on the book, or probably won't even read it. I mean, that's just the truth, right? Something that I remember a friend of mine saying, I get trashed for being such a big self-marketer. And so someone's like, it's not that it's about me, it's just that I don't see you doing it for me. So I have to do it because you're not telling people read my book. I'm telling people to read my book. Now, if all my friends did it, maybe I could take a break and post a picture of my you know, my tree growing out back. But until then, I'm going to market the hell out of the book.
We've been talking for a while, and I'm so thankful for this. And but, you know, Teresa's a genius, and one of the things that she has us ask is, what's the most difficult poem to write? Which one was the most difficult poem to write in this text? And then also, conversely, what was the easiest poem to write? And of course, you know, I'm a professor, and Teresa's a professor and a teacher as well, too. So, you know, we got to put the "and why" tag on as well.
One of the most difficult ones to write for me was blue food coloring that I have in Cry Howl, because it talks about the suicide of my great grandmother and how I wish she could come back, because she's got a great granddaughter and I want her to know more about her, and also my grandmother, who she left when she was a child, when she was 2-3 years old. Reading that just really choked me up, and that's the difficult part of it, is because it's real. And it's in a time now where people are paying attention, or at least are talking about mental illness as an issue. And it's not looked at as, oh, it's such a sin and you're going to go to hell. I mean, our culture teaches that, but women back then, or even men, never got the help they needed for what they were feeling. That was such an important poem, but it was also one of the toughest ones to bang out. And there's other ones there of, you know, my mother at the cemetery. I still write a lot about my father, his passing. And there's one there titled Capsized, which talks about alcoholism and that my father was an alcoholic for a very long time. Those are difficult, but they're necessary to put out there, because I'm not afraid of vulnerability when it comes to something that may teach or inspire or give hope or healing to someone. And so people know that they're not alone when it comes to losing a family member to mental illness. I guess I would say the funnest one I had writing was I Returned to Love, L.A., because it just brought back so many memories, and I feel like it was still unfinished. I felt like I could have gone on and wrote a whole book about returning to Los Angeles and loving it. That one was fun. I guess being fun made it easy too, because it just...
Yeah, that's lovely. And I think that's really a great prompt that could be useful for anyone. What's something fun to write about that you could go on and on and on about for days? That is really, really helpful, Edward. I am noticing, I can't believe how fast time has gone. Edward, is there anything else you want to leave us with? Any recommendations, what we should be reading right now?
I think that everyone should read in general, but I think that people should start reading their own thoughts and their own past and putting it on paper. When they're writing, it's sort of like journaling. You will find those nuggets in there that you will go back to and say, wow. Because everyone is different, and everyone has a different story, and everyone has a different way that they can help society. And to keep your generosity of your life from people is a disservice. I would say write about it. Think that you're great and not feel like, oh, there's other people that are great. No. They've just been doing it, and they've had doors open up for them, and it's okay. There are a lot of great people that have never been published or were published once they were not here on Earth anymore. It's like, don't think of, what am I going to get from it? When you start thinking of, what am I going to get from it, that's when you start to fail as a writer. What can I give? It should be the mentality. What can I offer through my writings, through my personal experiences, and embrace being vulnerable every once in a while. Because believe me, even though we're writing to heal others, most of the time we're healing ourselves. And it makes us a little better, and it also gives us that push to do great.
Doug, anything you want to say before we part?
No, I just want to thank you so much for your work and send love and power and just all the
good and calming vibes I can to you and everyone in Texas, and just know that we send in love here from California. And again, thank you so much for your poetry of resistance, your poetry of witness, your poetry of eco-poetry. Honestly, it's just a really, really strong text. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you so much.
And I will also just say thank you for bringing the voices of other writers out into the world through Flower Song Press. I got to attend one of your readings with the Flower Song Press authors recently, and it was just a thrilling evening. There's some really, really beautiful poetry coming out of that press. So to our listeners, definitely read Edward's book, Cry Howl from Prickly Pear, but also check out Flower Song and get all of their books. And then go find a quiet place where you can read and get inspired to do your own writing. As Edward said, everyone has something. Edward, once again, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. But I also hope I get to see you at readings and other events via Zoom in the not so distant future.
Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Trisha at thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Trisha at thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!